Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is an absolute pleasure and an honour for Frumstock Ward to welcome back Vanessa Beely. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Vanessa, she's an independent researcher and journalist who has travelled extensively throughout the Middle East, notably Gaza, Syria and Yemen. Vanessa has written in depth about conflicts in the region and has meticulously gathered many testimonies. Vanessa has previously provided evidence to the UN Human Rights Council. This concerned the use of US manufactured cluster bombs by the Saudi regime against defenceless Yemeni civilians. Her work has appeared on Russia Today, 21st Century Wire, a UK column to name but a few. She also has her own blog entitled The War Will Fall. During August this year, Vanessa spent 4 weeks in Syria meeting with Syrian people from all walks of life, from firemen to doctors to community and religious leaders up to high-ranking public officials, culminating in a meeting with Bashar al-Assad. Yet again, Vanessa's observations seem to be in stark contrast to the tired narratives which are peddled by our so-called free press. Indeed, the doublespeak-style misinformation presented by our media really would try and have us believe that war is peace. So, this evening we have a rare opportunity to hear the other side of the story, to hear the voices of the Syrian people and how they feel about this war and what has happened to their country over the last 5 years or so. So please give a warm welcome to Vanessa.
Good evening. I'm going to try and not break anything before I start. And first of all, my apologies for arriving so late. And for keeping you all waiting, thank you for your patience. It was one of those moments where technology beats tradition, Brian, wherever Brian is.
Another discussion about that later.
Yes, we will. Men and map reading, that's all I'm going to say. That's maybe more controversial than even talking about Aleppo, but... Right, what I'm going to try and do tonight, I don't know how many of you came to my White Helmet talk here a few months ago. I'm going to basically focus on Aleppo, because for me Aleppo is very much a microcosm of what is going on inside Syria. We have a situation in Aleppo where pretty much 75% of the civilian population, the majority of the population of Aleppo, has been ignored by Western media, Western governments, Western NGOs, think tanks, humanitarian organizations. And for me, this is a clear demonstration of what is happening in Syria, in that the majority voice of the majority of Syrian people is being marginalized and ignored. And so what I'm going to start by doing is demonstrating what it is that most people know about Aleppo from the media in the West. The majority of people, and I'm obviously not including the more informed people that are you, the majority of people in the West still think that Aleppo is one city, one homogenous city, that is largely being attacked, bombed on a daily basis by the Russians and the Syrian air forces. So the moderate rebels are being attacked disproportionately by Russia and Syria. The other myth that pervades the narrative on Syria is, of course, the chemical weapon myth that has been in existence since 2013 and has sort of gathered force as the narrative against Syria has escalated, commensurate, I have to say, with Syria's resistance against foreign intervention into a sovereign nation. They have actually been resisting now for 5.5 years, which is an extraordinary feat of bravery and courage on behalf of the Syrian state, the Syrian institutions, and the Syrian people. So one of the main narratives, one of the main underpinning narratives, is that the Syrian government, or regime as it's called very often in the West, is using chemical weapons against its own civilians. The majority of Western media bases its narrative upon information that is fed to them by what they will term local citizen journalists and activist groups. I will be discussing these in greater detail further on in my presentation. And then, of course, the other underpinning narrative is the humanitarian disaster and siege and starvation, followed by, of course, the never-ending hospitals being bombed, the last hospitals, the last eight hospitals, the last five hospitals, the last doctor, the last three doctors, the last paediatrician. You know, the last something or other in Aleppo has been the running narrative, I would say, pretty much throughout 2016. Again, the reason that I'm putting these up is not to go through them now, but to hopefully cover them through my presentation, through the journey that I'm actually going to take you on into Aleppo that I made myself in August this year. Part of the presentation, however, I still want to focus on what I consider to be the propaganda implants inside Syria that are producing the information for the propaganda mill outside Syria, how they've been created, who has placed them or planted them inside Syria, embedded them inside Syria, and who is actually responsible for these organizations, what their role is inside Syria, and that includes the White Helmets, and I'll be giving you an update through the presentation. So, it's a journey to Aleppo. What I'm basically going to do is to walk you through the journey that I made myself in the middle of August this year. I went with another extremely brave colleague, Ava Bartlett. The two of us travelled on our own together with our translator and with the driver. So we made this journey not as a privileged media organisation that the majority of them are, I have to say. Actually, while we were in Damascus, and I won't name the media outfit, but Ava and I were the only two at that point that were actually allowed into Aleppo. There were about five or six other media organisations that were refused entry because there had been such an escalation in fighting between the Syrian Arab Army and the various militant factions inside Aleppo. And we know for a fact that one particular mainstream media outlet, because it wasn't allowed into Aleppo, instead of occupying its time going to speak to Syrian people, it simply sat in the hotel and drank its way through the majority of the bar for 3 days before it went home. So that to me was very indicative of what these media outlets do. They're reliant upon the information being fed to them. Even when they're in an area, their desire to speak to the people, to find the truth, to objectively go out and be journalists is not there. I didn't see it. I didn't see a desire from any of them to actually be finding out the truth inside Syria. The journey to Aleppo would normally, according to Google Maps, take around 6 hours. It took us, I would say, around 7 hours, so actually it wasn't too bad. The normal route, however, would take you up towards the west of Aleppo. Because of the various terrorist, militant, moderate rebels, in inverted commas, brigades that litter the route, and also at that point were surrounding particularly the east and the southwest of Aleppo, we actually had to cut up through Homs, Hama, and then out into the eastern country, swing around Aleppo, actually skirting the various militant brigades that are embedded to the east of Aleppo, swing around the top and then come in the north. So it was a very sort of convoluted journey for our own security. The first myth, as I told you, is that what we always hear or have been hearing, only very recently has this narrative been sort of picked apart a little bit by the mainstream media. Aleppo is a tale of two cities, and I'll explain why. This map, which is probably now a little bit out of date, as you can see, the green area are the militant factions. Now, in this area, which is effectively East Aleppo, There are probably around an estimated 22 brigades of militant factions overlorded by Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. The reason that Nusra Front takes over any area in which it is working with associated militant brigades is because Nusra is the best funded, it's the best equipped, it's the best armed, and it's the best trained. So although you will find in amongst these brigades factions like Nur al-Din Zinki, who were responsible for the beheading of the 12-year-old Palestinian child Abdullah Issa a couple of months ago, you'll find out al-Sham, which is not yet designated by the United States as a terrorist organization, despite carrying out probably some of the most vicious and brutal ethnic cleansing exercises in Syria. And various other sort of minor brigades, which would probably have originally been part of the Free Syrian Army. But the Free Syrian Army, and this is a very important point to make, the Free Syrian Army actually from very early days ceased to be able to function without the logistical, weaponry and equipment support of the larger terrorist organizations like Nusra Front and like ISIS, like al-Sham, like Jaish al-Islam, all the various more heavily funded organizations. In West Aleppo, as I mentioned to you, there are 1.5 million civilians. So this red area, which is under government control, has two-thirds of the population of Aleppo. In East Aleppo, the figures are very difficult to pin down at the moment. When we actually went there, the Aleppo Medical Association, the official association for all medics and hospitals and medical staff inside Aleppo proper, told us that there were around 200,000 people in East Aleppo, but that the majority were actually probably the various militant factions and their families. So, again, as I say, it's very hard to give you an exact figure, particularly as recently the humanitarian corridors have been opened. Civilians have been able to leave under duress. Again, we'll get to that later on in the presentation. But this is just to show what the West describes as Aleppo is actually this green strip here. It completely ignores the plight of West Aleppo that has been under siege by the various militant factions since 2012. So this is a very important point to make, and it's a point that is systematically ignored by Western media. The road into Aleppo is very much like this. It varies. It goes through towns like Homs, which is one of the probably the most devastated towns along that route. As we pass through Homs, there's a road there which has been nicknamed now the Road of Death. That road itself in around 2012-2013 was under siege by the various militant factions led again by Nusra Front from four directions. And these terrorist factions on a daily basis were firing mortars, explosive bullets, they were sniping, they were sending in suicide bombers. Homs is probably one of the worst hit by suicide bombers, suicide cars, suicide trucks. So this was a familiar sight. I mean, it's very hard to describe as you're driving through these areas. And as you're driving through, you're getting a running commentary from both the driver and from our translator. At this point, we were only about 2 kilometres away from the nearest ISIS factions, for example. So the route is littered with sites like this. You see unexploded missiles, you see abandoned tanks, cars overturned like this. It's, without being sensationalist, it's like driving through a Mad Max film or through some sort of apocalyptic vision. It's incredibly saddening and very sobering to see the destruction that has been inflicted upon this country. At this point, we were actually told, at this point, we're getting a little bit closer to Aleppo, and all the way along the route, you go through Syrian Arabi checkpoints. The point of these checkpoints, is to check vehicles, one for explosive, two for weapons, and also to prevent any potential suicide bombers or extremists getting through into the civilian areas. At this point, it was quite sort of slightly amusing tale. We reached a T-junction, and I actually just photographed this couple that was stood on the T-junction. We should have turned left. Our driver at this point, with all the various deviations, turned right. At this point, two Syrian Arab army soldiers screamed after us in an old truck and said, no, for God's sake, turn left, because had we continued down that road, we'd have ended up in a Daesh encampment. So that's just to give you an impression of when you're making these journeys inside Syria, it's a very strange feeling. You can be somewhere that looks normal. People are outside selling vegetables, they're outside having coffee, they're talking. But then you realise when somebody points out that the next village is actually occupied by ISIS or by Nusra. At night, quite often, these terrorist factions will come into the safe villages. Quite often, they'll lay mines on the road so that when people leave their homes in the morning to go to their farms or to go to their work, they're killed in this way. So you're never very far away from terrorist infringement into your life. And even when you feel almost deluded into a sense of security, you're very quickly brought up and made to realise that actually there's never really very much security throughout the country. Everywhere we went, the Syrian Arab Army, again, a very important point to make and something that the Western media is very good at obscuring for us. The Syrian Arab Army is the Syrian people. You can't divorce one from the other any more than we can divorce our armed forces from our families and our children here in the UK or in the United States. There is not one family in Syria that doesn't have a member of their family in the Syrian Arab Army. So when the Western media describes them as Assad's thugs or Assad's army or Assad's soldiers, it's a completely misleading statement, because in Syria, they are treated like family. I mean, we pass them on the road carrying their rucksacks, heading for Aleppo, for the battle zone, for the front line. And you would see cattle trucks like this, or duff carts. Any form of vehicle would stop and pick them up and carry them on to the next front line or to the next destination. These guys are treated with huge affection and admiration, and there are people inside Syria who, despite the fact that they are suffering under the sanctions, that they don't have enough food to eat, they're cooking every day what little they do have and carrying it to the front lines for the soldiers. Because for the majority of the Syrian people, these guys are what stands between them and massacre. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. Because if the various militant factions break through into any of the what they perceive to be the resistant areas inside Syria, in other words, the areas that have remained loyal to the Syrian state, to the Syrian government, and to the Syrian army, they will be massacred. There's no way around this. There's no mercy for these people. So for them, the Syrian Arab Army is their family, it's their protection, it's their shield against what is happening in their country. This is the very first... I don't know why I'm getting... Am I moving somewhere? This is the first sighting of Aleppo. You can just see it in the background there. Sniper alleys. As we came into Aleppo, you noticed that the various roadsides are piled high with rubble and sand, and often with discarded vehicles like this. This is to prevent the militant snipers, getting a sight on you as you're driving along.
this again. This was our first sighting of
Aleppo, and this was the Ramusi area, which at that point was the scene of some very fierce battles between the Syrian Arab army, and at that point it was Nusra Front that were holding that area. The day before we arrived, the moderate rebels had fired mortars into what was basically a tar factory, and that's what you can see burning in the background there. Everywhere we went, we saw the debris of the Hellcannon missiles. These gas canisters, water heater canisters, any form of container that they get hold of, are packed full with explosives, shrapnel, glass, nails, chemicals, anything that they can find, and are then fired indiscriminately into the civilian areas of West Aleppo. These were described by Stefan de Mistura almost as trinkets. These things weigh 25 kilos. When they are packed with explosives, the damage they do is indescribable. They will just obliterate children. They'll take their limbs off. They are so destructive. And then the fact that they pack them full of nails, shrapnel, glass, these are just killing machines. I can't describe what damage they do. And the next video will just demonstrate to you how they're actually used by the so-called moderate rebels. This is actually the FSA, the so-called moderate section of the militant brigade. So these are positions in East Aleppo, and they're positioned to fire into civilian and residential areas in West Aleppo. This is all day, every day, day and night. This doesn't let up, even during a ceasefire. Ceasefire does not apply to the United States backed various brigades in East Aleppo. As I mentioned, we had to go up to the north of Aleppo and then almost swing back round on ourselves to come in through the Sheikh Maksud area, which is the Kurdish held area right in the north. To do so, we actually went past Aleppo prison, and one of the really interesting facts that I found out at this point about this building was, again, not mentioned in Western media at all, was that this was actually under siege by terrorist factions led by Nusra Front in, I think it was 2013. And inside were prisoners, but with the prisoners were Syrian Arab Army soldiers. And then basically what happened was there was negotiation going on between the Nusra Front and the Syrian government in order to release the prisoners. But why did they want the prisoners released? Because they wanted to take them into the ranks of their militants. And this was not an isolated incident. In my time in Syria, everyone I spoke to said, but this is what they did. They came into the various cities, they released the prisoners from the prison. So we're talking quite possibly rapists, murderers, felons, criminals, smugglers, drug dealers and drug users that were released and then taken into the various militant factions. So these are the people that are fighting against the Syrian people. We also drove through many of the sort of decimated industrial areas of Aleppo. Aleppo was, and will be again for sure, the industrial hub of Syria. And in fact, Dr. Bashar al-Jafri, at the UN in New York, he made it very clear that from 2012, Turkey, who to a large extent controls the various militant factions in and around Idlib and Aleppo, they actually dismantled 1,441 factories from the industrial areas in Aleppo. They dismantled them, they took them, and they re-established them in Turkey. So, you know, this extraordinary crime has been, yet again, completely blanked out and disappeared by Western media and Western governments. And the devastation that this causes to the people that ran those factories, to the people that worked for those factories, cannot be, it can't be sort of underestimated. There are people that have committed, I was told of people who've committed suicide because basically their entire livelihood disappeared. Their ability to take care of their families was just disintegrated in front of them. So, you know, while this may appear to be a minor crime compared to what is going on inside Syria, it still has its incredibly devastating effects on the Syrian people. So as we circled around and came in via the north, via the Sheikh Maksoud area, which is a Kurdish area, which again has come under huge attack, mostly from ISIS in the north, actually, and also suffered at least two or three chemical attacks. Another point that is never made by Western media is that Nusra Front actually took over the only chemical factory in Aleppo in 2012. They destroyed the factory, but they stole all of the ingredients, all of the equipment from inside that factory. So they have the capability, and that has been now documented and admitted, they have the capability to make the chemical weapons that are being used in West Aleppo. Again, I'll come on to that shortly. As we enter Sheikh Maksoud, as you say, you can see the devastation. This area had fairly recently been liberated by the Syrian Arab Army and allies, and it's now back under Kurdish control. So the checkpoints we were actually going through were Kurdish rather than Syrian. But this is an entire neighborhood that has just been decimated. As you come deeper into West Aleppo, which is government held, you start to return to this sort of degree of normalcy or normality. Now, we'll talk a little bit about the real Aleppo. And for me, the real Aleppo is West Aleppo, where 1.5 million civilians take shelter from the daily deluge of mortars, explosive bullets, sniper fire. I'll demonstrate how they use this to basically clear entire residential areas and then occupy them. And this is how they took over East Aleppo, was by moving forward, sniping, pushing people. Over 600,000 people fled from East Aleppo to West Aleppo at the very beginning of the invasion of the militant factions. And the horror that the civilians live under in West Aleppo is indescribable. Ava's just come back from spending a few days there. And in fact, I have one clip of a man whose two-year-old son was killed 2 days ago. It's very distressing. But I think you need to see it, because he is one out of maybe 20 per day that are being killed in West Aleppo. Even when we were there, we were walking in the streets and suddenly we could hear some explosives just behind us, so about 500 meters away. And we heard that they had just fired indiscriminately mortars into a park at the time that the children would have come out and would be playing in the park after they'd been at school all day. This is quite normal. We arrived on around the 14th of August. When we met with the Aleppo Medical Association, they told us that in that period, between the end of July and the 14th of August, over 153 people had been killed. Of that, 54 were children. So in a two-week period, 54 children were massacred by these terrorist attacks into West Aleppo. People keep picking me up on why I use the word terrorist. The reason I use it is because the Syrian people use it. They do not differentiate between the so-called moderate rebels and the extremists. For them, every single one of these various splinter factions, brigades, militant groups is capable of murder. And so for them, they're all terrorists. They don't. When I actually say to them, well, Was it Nusra Front? Was it the Free Syrian Army? They almost laugh at me. They almost say, well, what difference does it make? If they come into this area, they kill us. So as far as we're concerned, they all come under the same umbrella. As far as they are concerned, they're not Syrian. A recent German think tank actually estimated around 360,000 foreign mercenaries are fighting inside Syria now, just to give you an idea. The following was a very quick, I hope the sound's okay, interview that I did with Dr. Bassem Hayek, he deals with the psychological trauma of people coming from East Aleppo into West Aleppo. So he was in charge at that time of the recently opened humanitarian corridors that allowed civilians to get out of East Aleppo and back into West Aleppo. His team was in charge of the psychological rehabilitation and trauma care for these people that he describes, and you'll hear him describe it, have been basically living as hostages in East Aleppo, hostages to Nusra Front and their associated militant brigades inside East Aleppo.
And one of the European guests, committee and American, cutting off from your vote. Okay. So, I mean, this is, I can say that we didn't talk about this organization, White Families, and all the work there is happening by some local staff. With some foreigner staff, they came from Egypt, from India, from Pakistan, from Gulf region, but usually Syrian people are there and they are not fully trained. They only for 2 or 3 months training from other facilities. But White Remnants, we didn't hear about it, and we don't know about it. And even our family there, or our relative there, they didn't hear about this committee. And even with our relation with WHO, with UN, with the Red Crescent, nobody speak about this one.
So if the White Helmets were being live-streamed to the United Nations Security Council last week from Eastern Aleppo,
yes.
As far as you are concerned, you're not aware of an organization called...
Okay, this report, maybe somebody working on the ground, give it to them, mm-hmm. their office, and they make the report, and send it to them. But in the ground, they are not there. Because even UN staff and WHO staff, they are working with us. We are sending them daily in our hotel. And even for them, we didn't allow to go there from approximately 2 months.
Okay, and when was the last time that you were in Eastern Aleppo?
For me, I'm not going usually there because last year I have been, I can't go there. Last time I went there from 1 year.
Okay, but do you have contacts on the ground?
Because half of our family is there. Still, okay. They are occupied by the terrorists and they didn't allow them to come here. I mean, especially who has some medical training. My cousin, she is working as an anesthesiologist. They capture her and they say, if you go to Aleppo, the Western one, we will kill your family. Mm. So the family is, they take the family and they say, if you go to work in government hospital, we will kill your family. So she stayed there. Mm. And again.
For those, I mean, it's not very good sound quality, but 2 or 3 very important points were made there that I think you maybe all got, but I'll just recap them. First of all, I was asking him specifically about the White Helmets. Now, his response was, they do not work in East Aleppo. This response was then corroborated by various other organizations that I spoke to in West Aleppo. So what this actually means is that the White Helmets, on whom the Western media, the Western NGOs, the Western think tanks, the Western governments base their entire evidence and narrative against Syria, are not known to be operating as humanitarian rescues in East Aleppo. And he pointed out that they work with WHO, they work with the UN, and even they are not aware of the White Helmets working in East Aleppo. This is a huge admission on behalf of the Aleppo Medical Association. And then he mentions the fact that civilians, and he has family in East Aleppo, are held there against their will. And in fact, he mentions that he has a cousin who's a surgeon who had tried to come to West Aleppo to work in the hospitals there. And basically, they're told that if they go, their family that remains in East Aleppo will be punished, will be killed, executed. And the other point that he made is that he hadn't been able to go into East Aleppo for a year. But this is what he didn't elaborate on there, but he did later, is the fact that the government had actually paid doctors from West Aleppo to go into East Aleppo to treat civilians, but not only civilians, to treat anybody that actually needed care in East Aleppo. But the terrorists prevented them coming in. So once again, and this was another common theme that I saw when I was in Syria, is that the Syrian state is working to provide every level of care to its civilians. Who is preventing it? It's the terrorist brigades, it's the militant factions. They are preventing it. As they're preventing the doctors coming in, they were preventing the humanitarian convoys entering East Aleppo also. So again, you know, it's breaking through this sort of media bubble that surrounds the narrative on Syria and finding the pieces of truth and objective testimony that are existing but are simply being stifled and muted by Western media. This is a report from Mirad Gajdiev, who's one of the few reporters. He reports for RT, but he's one of the few who has been consistently on the ground in Syria and not relying on citizen journalists or activists. This is his view, very quick view, of East Aleppo in the last couple of weeks.
Checkpoint Salaudi. That's Eastern Aleppo. And that's Western Aleppo. This destroyed street is one of the checkpoints that people used to use to cross between the two, from the rebel side to the government side. Now, nobody uses it. The rebels have completely locked down East Aleppo. They're not letting anyone out. Not women, not children, not the sick.
Also, a recent update is that, in fact, when Ava was there and another friend of mine, Tom Duggan, who's reporting out of Damascus but has spent some considerable time at the front lines in Aleppo with the Syrian Arab Army, both of them told me, along with another doctor that we work with, Dr. Nabil Antaki, who's a gastroenterologist in Aleppo, is that the humanitarian vehicles from the government, from the Syrian state, have been lined up for the last 3 weeks to come into East Aleppo to evacuate all injured elderly and children, including, again, militant factions. They're not differentiating between civilians and militants. They were offering to take out all wounded. These vehicles have been prevented from entering East Aleppo, and civilians have been prevented from leaving. In fact, we've heard various narratives in the last few days of the militant factions charging civilians to leave East Aleppo. I think it's about $300 per head it works out, or it equates to. These people are starving. These people have been under siege in a hostage situation for 4 years. They have nothing, and the terrorists know this. The other thing that we saw is civilians trying to leave, or even militants trying to defect, are fired upon and killed before they can leave East Aleppo to reach West Aleppo. And in fact, the following is a video from Ruptly which shows exactly what happens when they're leaving. So as they exit the humanitarian corridors, they're met by teams of the trauma units that have been established by the Aleppo Medical Association. By the way, just going back to the last doctor, the last five doctors, the last eight doctors in Aleppo, there's 4,160 practicing doctors in West Aleppo, hardly the last doctor. But extraordinary that Western media never mentions this. In fact, as Ava described, they disappear, 4,160 doctors, in their narrative about Aleppo. These are the moderate rebels. This is actually Al-Arsham. They're preparing for an attack on Western Aleppo. This was in the last 2 or 3 days. So these are the moderate rebels. These are the rebels that the civilians of West Aleppo have to face every single day.
سوف الشمس لن يبقى لحين سرمدا
This had me in tears, so I apologize to some extent for showing it to you, but this is what West Aleppo is going through every day right now. We met victims of these attacks. We spoke to people that live in areas where these deluge of mortars come in every single day. For those of you who are interested in following somebody on the ground in Aleppo, I would recommend Pierre Lecourf, who's a young Frenchman. He's a volunteer. He's working in West Aleppo, but right on the borders with Eastern Aleppo, with the militant held areas. And he's extraordinarily brave. He was interviewed on 21st Century Wire a couple of weeks ago. But please follow him, because he's neutral, he's a volunteer, he's a genuine humanitarian, and he's working completely off his own back with no funding inside West Aleppo, purely as a because his humanity dictates to him that that is what he must do. This was actually tweeted by Murad Gashdiev, but I actually found out later it was filmed by one of the Syrian channels inside West Aleppo. But a very important point to make again, while the Western media narrative has continued to demand a no-fly zone, a no-bomb zone, a safe zone, whatever pretty title they want to give it, for a we bomb, you don't zone, is how I describe it, which we know from history, and from the majority of any sort of legal scholar will tell you that a no-fly zone is equivalent to devastating any target nation and reducing Syria down to the failed statehood that Libya has suffered under NATO intervention. This was filmed 2 days ago, and this man's two-year-old boy was murdered. These boys as well were photographed by Pierre Lecourf. What they're actually showing you are their sniper scars. The militant factions target the children on their way to school and on their way back. And this is how they progress forward or encroach upon civilian territory, is that they create an atmosphere of such fear and uncertainty that eventually people move out of that particular area. When we went to Aleppo, we basically couldn't afford the hotel prices. So we sort of begged and borrowed and found somebody who's living in Europe now, but he basically abandoned his apartment because it was right on the border with the terrorist held areas, and he said, "Well, pick the keys up and go and stay there. There's no electric, there's no water, and you're in a pretty dodgy area, but you can have it for the time that you're in Aleppo." And we could see that in that building alone, only one of the apartments was inhabited. The majority had just fled. Others, the windows were completely covered. What you'll find is they'll use any sort of sheet to try and cover the window so that the snipers can't see into the rooms of the apartment or of the house, because they'll fire into the house, they'll snipe into the house, and they're doing this across Syria. And they'll pick off children, mothers. I mean, it's indiscriminate killing. This is what you'll see very often, is these sheets are sort of draped across the road. You'll see all the remnants there from the mortar fire into this particular area. The sheets are draped across again to try and reduce the vision for the snipers. I mentioned Pierre de Korff, and again, what we're seeing, what I believe we're witnessing, is a cynical weaponization of children by the West, by NATO states, by the governments, by the media. All of us were caught up in the imagery of Omran Deknash, for example, and I'll talk about him in a minute. But for a second, let's just think about Mahmoud. Mahmoud was actually born without arms, so he was already disabled to a huge extent. He and his family managed to escape East Aleppo, and as they were escaping and trying to get into West Aleppo, Mahmoud trod on a militant mine, which removed both his legs, or rather it destroyed them to the extent that Dr. Nabil Antaki, who we speak to regularly, told me, I had to amputate. These children are never mentioned. They're just not recognized by Western media. Nor is the fact that when areas are liberated by the Syrian Arab Army, as here, for example, when the humanitarian corridors opened and when civilians actually made it out of East Aleppo, there was jubilation and there was celebration that these people could actually get out of the hell that they'd been forced to live in for the last 4 years in East Aleppo. Again, it's not mentioned. Now what I'd like to do is just move on to the actual propaganda apparatus. And I'll come back to Aleppo after I've sort of run through some of the major organizations and how they operate. I don't need to explain that. Can everybody? Sorry. On the throne of the world, any delusion can become fact. And I believe that when Syria has repelled all borders, when it has returned its country to how it should be, and when the consensus finally changes, we're going to see to what extent delusion has become fact in Syria. And I think it's going to be shocking even to those who are awake and who are aware to the propaganda war that is being waged against Syria. Everybody remembers this image of Omran Deknash, who was allegedly pulled out of the rubble of a bomb building. He was then placed on a chair without any back brace or neck brace or anybody checking him or comforting him or treating his wounds, and he was photographed for probably about 5 minutes in the back of a pristine ambulance. And these images immediately went viral, disseminated by the usual mainstream media, and then of course picked up by the various governments and used to demonstrate how necessary a no-fly zone is, how necessary greater military escalation was. So in other words, to call or to describe peace as being only achieved by war. Then let's look at who took the photograph of Omran Deknash. This guy here, Mahmoud Raslan. And here, he's seen and he's identified as a member of Nor al-Din Zinki. Nor al-Din Zinki were the group who publicly tortured, humiliated, and beheaded 12-year-old Abdullah Issa. The United States Department has still not admitted that this was a crime committed by United States funded, backed and armed terrorist groups. It's still not admitted it. It's still calling it alleged. It's still looking into it. While the crime or the alleged crime against Omran Deknash is accepted and run with without any investigation. Then let's look at who produced the video of Omran Deknash and the rescue by the White Helmets. Aleppo Media Centre. Aleppo Media Centre disseminated their video and their evidence to virtually every mainstream media outlet on the planet. Aleppo Media Centre, what a surprise. First of all, it's a part of the Syrian Expatriates Organization. And as SOPNET said, sign of the times, media outlet, independent media outlet, the SEO is what it sounds like. A group of American citizens of Syrian extraction who have their offices on K Street in Washington, D.C., a street that is famous for being the center of the American political lobbying industry, with numerous think tanks, lobbyists, and advocacy groups based there. But that's not all. The Aleppo Media Center was set up and funded by a group called the Syrian Media Incubator in the Turkish city of Gaziantep, so not inside Syria, outside Syria. And it's my belief that Gaziantep is the hub of the entire shadow state building project that is being led by the UK, France, and the United States. And again, I'll go more into that when I talk about the White Helmets. But where it gets really interesting is that the Syrian Media Incubator is a project funded by Canal France International, which is the French cooperation agency and media operator of the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So fundamentally, this is not a sort of neutral, objective, citizen journalist organization. This is a deliberately funded French Foreign Office implant embedded inside East Aleppo and producing the narrative that is aligned with the NATO agenda inside Syria. It is the weaponization of children. There's no other way to describe this. It's the most egregious, heinous, criminal use of children to sell a concept. It's a marketing ploy. There's no getting around this. And France, again, can hardly be considered an impartial player in the neo-colonialist game. In July 2015, a group of Syrian plaintiffs from inside Syria took the country's foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, to court for what they described as stoking the conflict. They had lost relatives in the conflict to the various terrorist factions. And in 2012, many of you may remember that Laurent Fabius, who was then foreign minister, gave an interview to Le Monde's paper in which he described what Al-Qaeda were doing in Syria as a good job. Very recently, Manuel Valls, French Prime Minister, showing here his very clear allegiance to Israel, the majority of the French government is extraordinarily allied with Israel. Just to give you an example, in 2014, when Gaza was being bombed mercilessly by Israel, I went to a meeting in Paris where I discovered that there is actually a tax break, an official government tax break, for businesses inside France if they contribute to the Israeli offence forces. There's an actual, if you go onto the government website, you receive a percentage reduction in your tax if you contribute to the Israeli army. In a recent speech at the Assemblée Nationale, Manuel Valls told members of the White Helmets that Aleppo is their battle, probably harking back to the time when Syria was a French colony, which ended in 1946, but maybe somebody should remind him. Honoured guests in France during that time were, as he's now called, President Raed Saleh of the White Helmets, and a guy called Britta Haji Hassan, with whom I've been having a very interesting conversation over the last few days. Raed Saleh, some of you may recognise as he calls himself now, the President of the White Helmets, the leader of the White Helmets, who, by the way, was extradited from the United States in April 2016. He was kicked out of Dulles Airport for his extremist connections. It was finally admitted by the US State Department. However, his extremist connections somehow didn't reflect upon the organization itself. I'm not quite sure how that one works when they bombed Iraq for their connections to Al-Qaeda, but hey, it's the United States. Britta Haji Hassan has called himself the mayor of Aleppo. However, my sources tell me that he's a member of Arawshan, as I said, one of the most brutal ethnic cleansing organizations inside Syria right now, still not designated a terrorist organization by the United States, who are desperately trying to keep the moderate level label stuck on some militant faction somewhere. Both of these guys were entertained as heroes in France, much to the disgust of many French, as the White Helmets have been proven to have connections to the very terrorist organisations that carried out the attacks in Bataclan, in Nice, and in Paris at Charlie Hebdo. So kind of an extraordinary turn of events. In fact, Maria Zakharova, who I had the privilege to meet with in Moscow about 10 days ago, she made the very clear point that these so-called local councils, the majority of whom have received their funding and training inside Gaziantep, as I mentioned, Gaziantep inside Turkey is the hub where they build these shadow state organizations to then send them into Syria to supplant the existing Syrian state institutions. This is a very common NATO intervention ploy. They carried this out in Iraq. They've done it pretty much globally. And she basically made the point that the illegal armed units have given complete control over life-sustaining issues in eastern Aleppo, such as electricity supplies, school education, and bakeries. They've turned it into work for the council, so the councils that are then run by terrorist leaders, and they then use this humanitarian instrument as a tool to keep the local population under control. Now, I've seen this personally in 2012 in Egypt, when the Muslim Brotherhood did exactly this exercise leading up to the referendum at the end of 2012. Which was instigated by Morsi to give him greater powers inside Egypt. I actually saw this. I was actually in Cairo during the referendum, and I could see that people were being forced to vote for the new constitution on the basis that the Muslim Brotherhood controlled all of the services in the various villages that they were coming from. So they controlled electricity, they controlled water, they controlled all of the hospital services, they controlled all of the education. So they had control over that population. Moving on to my favourite NGO in Syria, the White Helmets. You'll all be aware that they recently failed to get the Nobel Peace Prize. Something that I'm particularly proud of. We worked very hard leading up to that announcement. I worked with Nobel's Will, which is an organization in Norway and Sweden, which acts as a watchdog of the Nobel Prize award. And through them, I managed to get all of my evidence to the Nobel Prize Committee. Now, I can't take the credit for it, but I was told that in the closed chamber, people that were coming out were saying that there was a very last-minute change of direction, which is extraordinary when you look at the celebrity government media backing that was behind the White Helmets' bid for that prize. Just to give you a very brief recap, is anybody unaware of who the White Helmets are? Okay. The White Helmets are basically a supposed first responder humanitarian NGO inside Syria, operating inside Syria. They were set up in 2013 by this guy in the middle,
James Le Mesurier,
who's a British ex-military. He's been involved in pretty much every
NATO intervention
from Kosovo across to Afghanistan, to Iraq, to Palestine, to Yemen. He set up the White Helmets in 2013. He then also set up the Mayday Rescue in 2014. Mayday Rescue is now an official foundation, and it's through the Mayday Rescue that the majority of NATO state countries fund the White Helmet, and I'm talking up to 150 million in funding. So this is hardly a non-governmental organization operating inside Syria. It's received around $23 million from USAID, so the United States Department. It's received now, we think, around £65 million from the UK Foreign Office. Boris Johnson announced a few weeks ago that he would be giving them a further £32 million on top of the £19 million that was already given to them. And then various other countries have contributed. France, Germany, Denmark, Holland, Japan. And now, publicly, Qatar, who is probably one of the biggest financiers and controllers of the terrorist factions inside Syria, has publicly announced that they are funding the White Helmets. So, I mean, very clearly, even if we don't go any further, this is not an independent, impartial NGO. It cannot call itself that when its entire funding operation is coming from regimes who have stated and declared an interest in regime change in Syria. But then if we go back to James Le Mesurier's background, if we go to the Olive Group, which he was working in a few years prior to setting up the White Helmets, that merged with the Constellis Group in May 2015, and under the Constellis umbrella is the Blackwater Group, or as it's Academy. So this just gives an idea of the circles that James Le Mesurier moves in, which are the very high profile private security firms that are fundamentally nothing more than an outreach assassination program for the CIA. And I'm not being sensationalist. That again has been very clearly documented and extensively reported. It was set up under President Bush. President Obama then put $250 million into the Blackwater coffers before they were then renamed as Academy to again try and distance them from the crimes that they had been committing in various Middle Eastern countries in particular, particularly in Iraq. So again, I am not being sensationalist here. These guys are outreach and outsource agents for the various deep state and intelligence agencies for our governments. And then the connections to Good Harbor. Good Harbor International is another organization based in Dubai, run by CEO Richard A. Clarke, who was Bush's terror advisor, has close ties to Rita Katz, an Israeli-American who set up SITE. SITE Intelligence is the organization that basically diffuses all of the ISIS execution videos. And one has to ask how they get access to these videos before anybody else. So that just gives you an idea on the background of the White Helmets, on their funding, and on who created them, who trained them, and who released them back into Syria. And then if we look at where the White Helmets operate, they only operate in terrorist-held areas. And when I say terrorist, Nusra-held areas or ISIS-held areas. There is extensive video evidence and document evidence. We've spent the last 3 months going through individual social media accounts and highlighting and picking out all of the photographs which shows their allegiance to either al-Sham, to Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda, or to ISIS. And it's very clear, it's on every single of the individual White Helmet account. None of them are hiding it. And to give you an example, this is Abdul Halim al-Shahab. He's a White Helmet based in Idlib. When we started to go through his page, we discovered all sorts of posts, obviously in Arabic, so it takes some time for us to go through and to find people to be able to translate it for us. But for instance, on the right-hand side, you will see the body of a Russian pilot being dragged. This body was later dismembered by the Nusra Front in Idlib. This pilot and his crew had been shot down a few days before we went into Aleppo. They had been dropping humanitarian supplies into East Aleppo. They'd flown from the base in Latakia to East Aleppo. They'd dropped food and humanitarian supplies to the civilians and to the militants. They can't differentiate. And then they were on their way back. They were shot down by a ground-to-air missile. So these lightly armed moderate rebels shot down a Russian humanitarian helicopter. Thankfully, as we were told by some of the Russians that we met in Aleppo, the crew died almost instantly, including one woman. But their bodies were, as far as I know, dismembered, as are all the bodies of those lost in battle against these terrorist factions. And again, this was something that I was told by many people, that the great fear is if they lose a member of their family in one of these battles or in one of these clashes, their greatest fear is that they can't recover the body, because the body will be dismembered, it will be desecrated, it will be mutilated. It certainly will not be given the dignity of a burial, as is described by White Helmets in their promotional material. So if we look at all of these White Helmet pages, they were all basically celebrating the death of this Russian pilot that had just dropped humanitarian aid to their own colleagues in East Aleppo, and enjoying the fact that his body was being humiliated and desecrated like this. But then it gets even more interesting. On this same White Helmet page, he heard a meme up, which basically, when you translate the Arabic, it translates as exterminate Kafraya. Now, Fura and Kafraya are two Idlib villages, so they're right in the middle of the Idlib countryside. I hate using sectarian language, but I will use it only to demonstrate the White Helmet's lack of impartiality and their sectarian agenda inside Syria. Kafraya and Fura are Shia villages, Shia Muslim villages. They have been under partial siege since 2011 and full siege since March 2015. They've lost now probably nearly 2,000 civilians that have been shelled, sniped, just basically that the terrorists have tunneled underneath the houses and detonated underneath the houses. The residents are sniped inside their own kitchens. We met people in Damascus who had managed to get out of Kafraya and Fura despite the siege. One woman had been sniped in her own kitchen. She'd been shot through the head. The bullet had passed through her face and out the other side, and she was still completely paralyzed down her left side. Fairly recently, a young child, 7 years old, was shot, was sniped in the stomach. Again, these children, these civilians, are never mentioned in Western media, and the White Helmets, all over their pages, are calling for the extermination. So they're calling for a sectarian ethnic cleansing in Idlib, hardly the actions of a humanitarian NGO. And this is not isolated. I've just taken one example from one page, but every one of their pages has examples similar to this or even more extremist. They were awarded the Atlantic Council Freedom Awards this year, but a look at previous winners gives an indication as to why they received it. So John McCain and Hillary Clinton, probably two of the biggest war hawks inside the United States. Then we had the Netflix White Helmets film documentary, which was filmed entirely, or made entirely in Turkey, based on footage provided by the White Helmets. So the actual documentary makers never set foot inside Syria. The footage was supplied to them. It was not verified. It wasn't checked. It wasn't made sure that it was credible. It was just accepted, edited, and produced as a documentary. They have admitted this themselves in various interviews. Then let's have a look at who was behind the documentary. The Syria campaign was set up at the beginning of the war against Syria, and basically it runs the promotional activity for the White Helmets. And earlier this year, we picked up on a job advertisement from the Syria campaign, in which they mentioned that we have big things coming up this year, including several high-profile campaigns and a film with an Oscar-nominated crew and global distribution partner. Join us and help make them happen. So in other words, even before the Netflix documentary was made, and by the way, it is among the five nominees for, guess what, the Oscar this year. I'm just trying to show you that this is, it's a very high-powered, slick marketing campaign that is behind the White Helmets. This is not some grassroots organization that has no support. It is multi-million funded by NATO state members and by Gulf state members now. It has an entire PR and marketing machine running behind it, probably even Hollywood-based. And so therefore, it's kind of extraordinary to me that it has maintained its credibility as long as it has. They also won the Right Livelihood Award, which is sort of the alternative Nobel Peace Prize. That will actually, the ceremony is going to be either the end of November or beginning of December. I can't remember the date right now. But we have a campaign running on this as well, with the Nobel Peace Prize watchdog, to try and pressure the RLA to actually retract this prize. So if anybody is convinced by this talk, if anybody wants to talk to me about it afterwards, those who are protesting the White Helmets receiving this prize are writing in to the website for the Right Livelihood, which is info@rightlivelihood.org. I mentioned the fact that the Nobel Peace Prize was actually derailed, but extraordinarily, almost as if they were prepared for this to happen, the next day, if not the same evening, guess what? This simple bakers, butchers, carpenters, candlestick makers organization suddenly had a fundraiser going to let's sort of compensate the White Helmets for not having won not the Nobel Peace Prize, but the $1 million that came with the Nobel Peace Prize. Now we come to the interesting bit, for me anyway. One of the main reasons that I wanted to go to Syria was to meet with the real Syria Civil Defence. Not the White Helmets, as they call themselves, the Syria Civil Defence. They are not the Syria Civil Defence. The real Syria Civil Defence has been in existence since 1953. So for six decades, the White Helmets were set up in Turkey, not in Syria, in 2013, and it is funded not by Syria, it's funded by nations who want regime change in Syria. Very important fact here. What we are seeing here is primarily British-funded shadow state building, the undermining of the existing Syrian state institutions and the supplanting of them with NATO constructs, with, in this case, primarily British-funded constructs, the White Helmets. For example, when you need the fire engine or when you need first responders in Syria, you call 113. Exactly the same as, I hope it's still 999 in Britain. I haven't lived here for a while. There is no number for the White Helmets. There's nobody you can actually call. So that begs the question, well, what do people do who are in trouble? How do they get in touch with White Helmets? Or are they working purely as triage and support for the terrorist organizations with whom they're embedded? So the real Syria Civil Defense, who work in both terrorist and government-held areas, by the way, many of them have lost their lives going into terrorist-held areas to rescue civilians from under mortar fire or under guided missile attacks. The terrorist factions, by the way, to the north of Aleppo, particularly the brigades. Excuse me.
No, I've got one back here.
particularly the ones in Idlib, to the north of Aleppo. There are three particular brigades, 13th Division, the Mountain Hawks, and I can never remember the third one, are heavily funded by the CIA, trained by the CIA, and armed by the CIA. And they now have Grad missiles, which have come in from Bulgaria and Tunisia, among other countries. And these Grad missiles are now being used also against the northern areas of Aleppo, the city itself and the surrounding countryside. And these missiles are used against these first responders. When they go into terrorist-held areas, what is happening is that the militant factions are picking them off. For instance, we have here the remains of a fire truck that went to a call-out in Homs. This is actually from the real Syria Civil Defense headquarters in Damascus. They went to respond to a call from Homs to a civilian area that was under attack from the terrorist factions. As they drove into the mortar-hit area, they were actually hit by a guided missile, and all three crew members were wiped out instantly. This is, again, to me, this is part of the criminal activity by our government to destroy the Syrian institutions, the Syrian humanitarian institutions, the Syrian state institutions that are so cohesive inside Syria. It's an extraordinary thing to witness. The Syrian state's efforts to keep supplying its civilians, to maintain its infrastructure, despite, one, crippling economic sanctions that affect the real Syria civil defense, but do not affect the White Helmets. The White Helmets have no issue getting equipment into Idlib, by the way, from Turkey, from EU through Turkey and into Idlib. And then it's distributed to the White Helmet centers across the terrorist-held areas. They are not affected by the sanctions. These guys are. The real Syrian civil defense, if they run out of something, they don't get any replacement. For instance, the real Syrian civil defense in West Aleppo are dealing with chemical attacks almost on a weekly basis from the terrorists in East Aleppo. The reasons they lost one of their crew members, Mohammed Ibish, age 36, on the 2nd of August. Why? Because they have no gas masks. They haven't been able to replace them. So all they have are the paper masks, which are no defense against mustard gas, chlorine, any sort of chemical weapons that are being used against them in West Aleppo. And so, you know, this is a common occurrence, is that the Syrian state, the Syrian state institutions are battling the crippling economic sanctions, the intervention from NATO, which includes the invasion by proxy forces, and of course hostile propaganda, hostile diplomacy. This is Engineer Saad. He is based in the Damascus headquarters of the Real Syria Civil Defense, which, as we drove up to it, you have Jaish al-Islam directly and in front of you, about 50 meters away, and to the left you have Jobar, which is a very well-known terrorist-held area. So this entire center is under attack on a regular basis. Every time they go out to respond to a call, they are driving through terrorist-held areas. This guy was hit. You can see his left hand is slightly, it's hanging, it's paralyzed. He was hit in one of the attacks on the center. He was operated on for about 8 hours, and he still has no movement in that hand. This ambulance, for example, was stripped clean by the terrorists, and they've been unable to replace any of the equipment in it, any of the life-saving equipment in it. So it's useless as an ambulance. When I was in West Aleppo and I was speaking with the Real Syria Civil Defense there, what they also told me, there were members of the crew there who came from East Aleppo to West Aleppo, and they told me that when the terrorists came in 2012, they massacred crew members, they kidnapped others. One of those crew members that I spoke to had been told if he stayed, he had to work with the terrorists. He refused, he fled. They burnt down his house, they put his name on all of the checkpoints so that if he were to come back, he would be assassinated. And his family, who had to be left behind in East Aleppo, are under constant risk of execution. What he also told me was that those terrorists that came in 2012 then were transformed into the White Helmets. But he categorically said to me, they are not humanitarian workers, they are terrorists, they are armed, and they are working alongside the terrorists. Another very clear example, real Syria Civil Defense is a member of the International Civil Defense Organization. Just prior to the Nobel Peace Prize announcement, the link to the Syrian Arab Republic, Syrian Civil Defense, was broken and reconnected to the White Helmets by surprise. So luckily we noticed it, and we phoned them, and this was a conversation that I actually had with the ICDO. We ran through basically what had happened. He said it was an administrative mistake, fair enough. But the interesting fact that came out of it was that they do not recognize, and neither does the UN, they do not recognize the White Helmets as a first responder civil defense organization. Very important fact. How am I doing time-wise? As I mentioned, when you go to the White Helmet funding page, you'll see a very clear meme which shows all of the equipment and how you should be funding it. Well, that's very interesting if they were to be affected by the economic sanctions that is affecting every single other Syrian institution. However, as I mentioned to you, the White Helmets seem to be immune to sanctions. Then let's have a quick look at another media organization, Channel 4. A very recent video that they put out and then very quickly took down. I don't know if anybody actually noticed this, but this is indicative of Channel 4's reporting on the crisis in Syria. They've run with a very NATO-aligned narrative. They've become very bullish. In fact, I mentioned today, they've become the Fox News of UK media to a huge extent. They bully their interviewees. They maintain their propaganda line even when faced with evidence to the contrary. And in this particular video...
It's early morning and they're planning an attack. Their way of defending East Aleppo is to hit back by sending suicide bombers to the Syrian army. And by launching rockets into the west side of the city.
They just normalised suicide bombers and attacks on civilians in West Aleppo. That was just completely nonchalantly put into the report as if it's perfectly normal that suicide bombers should be used as a legitimate weapon against the indigenous national army, or that it's normal that they defend themselves by attacking civilians in West Aleppo. But that's not the worst part of this video. The actual stars of this video were the beheaders of 12-year-old Abdullah Issa. So Channel 4 is telling you that child beheaders and executors and torturers are rebels and deserve to defend themselves against the civilians of West Aleppo by mortaring them, by sniping them, by explosive bullets. Extraordinary, I find that extraordinary. Here's another identification. So these are the actual beheaders. They're not even just associated with Nur al-Din Zinki. They are the actual executors of that child. Now, when this was pointed out to Channel 4, and when in fact Channel 4 was attacked for this video, they immediately took it down. Unfortunately, many of us took a copy of it. And then in among these nice beheading operatives that they called rebels, we find, guess what? The White Helmets. Again, this is completely ignored by Channel 4. It's not even picked up on that somebody that has just been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize is running alongside child beheaders in East Aleppo carrying weapons. Great media we have. And then let's look at another. Dr. Hamza Khatib, one of the last doctors in Aleppo, before a few more came in. The BBC Channel 4 CNN poster boy. Now, here we have a photograph of Dr. Hamza Al-Khatib. alongside Fastakim. Now you might ask, who are Fastakim? They're a new one. But you're right, this is kind of the gangs and counter-gang warfare that is going on inside Syria. Fastakim are a splinter from Nur al-Din-Zinki, the child beheaders. Fastakim set up to distance themselves from Nur al-Din-Zinki, but they have the same ideology, the same extremism, the same methods of killing civilians as Nur al-Din-Zinki. They are basically Nur al-Din-Zinki rebranded. But here we have Channel 4's mainstay witness from East Aleppo discussing tactics with a terrorist organisation. Oddly enough, Channel 4, despite various emails and tweets from me, have not yet responded. Then we have CNN, Christiane Amanpour. Here, she's interviewing Molham Al-Qaidi. He's the leader of Fastakim, ex-Nur al-Din-Zinki. So actually, predominantly these days, we are getting the majority of our mainstream media narrative from terrorists. There's no other way around it. There was in Holland, there was a news report from East Aleppo from a guy that's on Britain's Al-Qaeda watch list. I mentioned to you about the crippling economic sanctions. The Syrian American Council, a few weeks ago, actually brought out a statement where they called for the UN to even stop its humanitarian assistance to the Syrian state and the Syrian people. This is an inhumane and criminal demand on behalf of the Syrian American Council. And I'll tell you why, because they based that statement upon the lie that the blood banks in Syria are run by the Ministry of Defense. And so therefore, Assad's soldiers are the first to get any blood from those banks. Now, when we were in Aleppo, they actually gave blood because there'd been recent attacks against civilians there, and we felt duty-bound, our conscience drove us to go and actually give blood at that point. Now, when we were there, we actually saw it is run by the military. It's run very effectively despite the sanctions. They've overcome the fact that they have no more plastic bags to store the blood in. They've overcome and adapted to that. And what we saw when we were there were the number of civilians that were coming in to give blood for members of their family and so on that had been hit by the mortar attacks in West Aleppo. So this completely undermined the Syrian American Council argument, and in fact, again, we wrote to them. We never got a reply. Just to run you through some images, this was Bani Zaid, an area to the north of Aleppo that had just very recently been liberated. The Syrian Arab Army basically tunneled their way through to the terrorist areas, and then they had about 5 days of hand-to-hand fierce fighting before they retook the whole area. As you can see, it was pretty decimated. This is Ahmed. He was a civilian volunteer in the army, and he had actually come to Bani Zaid to stand guard and to report back of any sort of terrorist activity in or around the area. And so for 2 weeks he'd been living in this bombed out house. You can see his bed in the background, and this was basically how he was living. He had, however, kind of made himself as comfortable as possible. One thing that you notice driving around Syria, whether it's West Aleppo, this is taken in West Aleppo, is that you will see the Syrian Arab Republic flag flying from almost every rooftop, from every balcony, painted on doors, on garage doors, anywhere it can be, on the checkpoints. To me, it symbolised the defiance of the Syrian people against what is being done to their country. This was in one of the parks in Aziza before we left. It was the last evening we were in Aleppo. And again, people are so surprised to sort of see foreigners like ourselves just wandering around Aleppo, not under the protection of the various ministries, because we're with mainstream media or anything like that, but just wandering around among the people themselves. And so many of them were actually really keen to speak to us. One of the narratives that I heard time and time and time again, particularly from Syrians that had lived or worked in Europe, or were there at the beginning of the conflict against Syria, was they said to me, you know, even in the beginning when we were in Europe, we were trying to explain to our European friends what was happening was not what they were hearing in the media, but they just laughed at it. This had me in tears at one point because I just thought, what have we become? You know, we're not even listening to the people that come from this nation. We're ridiculing them. We're working on a basis of such exceptionalism that has been implanted into us by our media, by our governments, by our various think tanks, NGOs, analysts, academics, doesn't matter. But when did we stop listening to the people who are trying to tell us what is happening inside their country? Not to representatives that have not lived inside Syria for the last 10 years or who have taken large amounts of funding external to Syria in order to propagandize against Syria. When did we stop listening to these people? These people that our governments are terrorizing and victimizing, destroying their history, destroying their culture. When did we stop listening to them? This was on the last morning, just as we were leaving the apartment. And somehow it symbolized everything that is great about Syria and that is heartbreaking but heart-filling at the same time, is literally just down the road that night we'd had mortar attacks and gunfire. And yet at 7 in the morning these two ladies were out on the balcony having a really animated discussion over a cup of tea. Somehow it was just wonderful. Again, just heading out of Aleppo, this was one of the houses that had been taken over by the terrorists and just transformed into a sniper tower, basically. The majority also of the hospitals in East Aleppo are or have been occupied by terrorists since 2012, and the top floors, we were told, are completely stripped and are now used as terrorist sniper towers. Whoever we spoke to inside Syria, and again, this is part of the dehumanization process by the Western media and governments against the Syrian people. For instance, coastal areas of Tartus or Latakia, for example, or even West Aleppo, are described as Assad strongholds, Assad loyalists. This completely dehumanizes and decolors the people that live in these areas, because even in West Aleppo, you have many people that are actually against the Syrian government, or they're not pro-Assad. But as Dr. Nabil Antaki here said, he's not pro-Assad, but he said he supports the Syrian state against the illegal NATO intervention inside Syria. And as he said very clearly, life was not perfect, but nobody wanted war, they wanted reform. And even the most outspoken enemies of the government did not want war, and they certainly did not want this war. They wanted reforms and they wanted democracy, but nobody wanted to kill Syria to improve Syria. And this is what I heard from every single Syrian that I spoke to in my time inside Syria. Not only me, but everybody that goes to Syria hears this time and time and time again. I also had the privilege to meet with and speak to Maria Sada. She's Christian, she's a member of the opposition party, and she's also a member of parliament, and she's a woman. And when I was talking to her, and we were talking about what would happen if, for instance, the NATO states got their way, the regime were changed, and Syria became an Islamist state, a Muslim Brotherhood-run Islamist state, what would happen to the freedom of these women who have a voice inside their parliament, which has been in existence for 100 years inside Syria, by the way? And this was taken from a speech that she gave at the UN in June 2016. We, the Syrian people, do not want any state to speak in our name. We have the right to decide and choose our destiny. The opposition is a legal structure inside the parliament and not outside the country related to foreign agendas. We want to start reform by involving all Syrians working together in partnership with the institutions of the state and not by killing each other. Democracy means a certain level of political culture. It is not something that is created out of war. The existence of state is our existence, so we are all responsible for saving this state. Again, this is the overarching, overriding impression that I got from the governorates that I visited, from the people inside those governorates, whether they were pro or against the government, it didn't matter. And the majority are pro the government. Even those that are against accept that the current government is the only unifying factor strong enough inside Syria to withstand all that is being thrown against Syria right now by our governments. I just want to finish off with a message from Gufran Derwan, who's a very dear friend of mine in Damascus. The day that I arrived in Syria, her sister Noor Derwan, 23 years old, and her one-year-old baby were killed in a restaurant in Bab Tuma in the old city of Damascus by a terrorist mortar that was fired randomly into that area. The body of her one-year-old boy was found 1 hour after they found her body because it had been flung into another room. So I want to leave you with this message from Gufran, because it's a Syrian voice. It's a Syrian voice that represents tens of thousands of Syrian voices inside Syria.
Syria, Damascus. I'm 35 years old. I'm a filmmaker and an English teacher too. What I want to say it's very painful to speak about the war on Syria because we were living in peace and our country was very, very safe. And we didn't think that such a thing would happen to Syria. This war affected us painfully, especially me, when I lost my sister and her little child by terrorists chilling on a restaurant in old Damascus. My sister went there to have a meal with her friends and she was murdered with four of her friends and with her child. My sister was 23 years old and her child was a year and a month. And we found the body of my nephews in a small room after an hour of the attack. It's hard to speak about them and what happened to them. I'm not the only person who lost a sister. There are many Syrians lost their relatives and sons, and it's very difficult to speak about how many people were killed in Syria. Hundreds of people killed here in Syria by terrorists. But especially who called moderates terrorists. It's difficult to speak about my country in this way and how we feel.
I think the message was pretty clear. And I, you know, all that she goes on to say is that Syrians want to live in peace. They want to rebuild their own country. They want to decide their own future. And that, whatever other arguments people come up with, that is the basic sacrosanct argument that should deny anybody intervention into a sovereign state is the UN Charter, that states that this is, you know, it's a supreme crime. And so therefore that is, that principle is what should be defended. And then it's up to the Syrian people to resolve whatever issues they have internally to Syria without external meddling. And so that basically was Gufran's message, despite the fact of her loss. And when I saw her, she was suffering with immense depression. That, again, is something that Syria is going to have to heal itself of, is the level of trauma that is going to reveal itself, even once these proxy military factions are driven out of Syria. There's an immense amount of healing that has to go inside Syria. Some of the stories I heard were horrific for me to listen to, let alone for these people to go through. And so Gufran's message, the message from the majority of the Syrian people, is please hear them, please listen to them, please stop marginalizing, please stop dehumanizing them, and please allow them the freedom to determine their own future.